Welcome to The Rubric. I'm your host, Joe Andrew.
I'm Erica Connell.
And I'm Eric Hsu.
Today on the show, we talk with Troy Ronda, editor of the DID Orb spec, and Mike Varley, who's been building the DID Orb implementation at SecureKey, now an Avast company. This is part two of our two-part interview about DID Orb. Part one can be found in the previous episode.
I think it lets us address the issue of, you know, networks of networks.
On the Rubric, we talk to folks making decentralized identity happen. We chat about the technologies and motivations behind decentralized identifiers, including DIDs, DID documents, and DID methods, so our listeners can make better decisions about which DID method or methods are appropriate for your use.
Decentralized identifiers enable identity-based services without dependence on a trusted third party. So instead of using centralized identity verification services like Facebook, Google, or the Department of Motor Vehicles, DIDs can be created by anyone, anywhere, and be used for any purpose.
DID methods are the magic ingredient that give DIDs their flexibility. Before creating any specific DID, you first choose a DID method, which specifies how to perform the create, read, update, and deactivate operations on a DID of that method. Once created, each DID includes the name of its method and the identifier itself, so that when you use the DID, others know how to retrieve the associated DID document that contains the cryptographic material for secure interactions.
Different DID methods use different underlying mechanisms with different performance, security, and privacy trade-offs.
This show, The Rubric, reviews different DID methods with their creators and implementers so you can make better decisions about when and how to use DIDs in your applications.
Troy Ronda is the editor for the DID Orb specification and leads the Trust Block development teams at SecureKey in Toronto, Canada. DID Orb implementation is part of Trust Block. Troy was chief scientist at SecureKey and is now director engineering.
Mike Varley is the Director of Architecture at SecureKey Technologies and has been involved in digital identity, authentication, payments innovation, and solution architecture for 10 years. Before his work at SecureKey, Mike was at Symantec.cloud and the wireless telecom startup Soma Networks. He has a passion for distributed system design, security, and end-user privacy, as well as making these complex systems accessible to non-technical individuals. Mike is a co-editor on the OpenID Connect iGov specification.
Here we continue the conversation. All right, now we'll turn our attention to the hard part of creating new technologies. What were the biggest challenges as you created DID Orb? This might include political conflicts, technical conflicts, or even people conflicts. We'll throw that out there, but what were the biggest challenges?
So you know, I don't know if these were challenges per se. I think, you know, the timing of when we worked on Orb was actually extremely fortunate that we had shifted our focus to this blockchain agnostic structure shortly before the Scitree V1 specification had been finalized. And so we were actually able to add some of the constructs that we needed into that specification before it became V1 and a diff ratified spec. So as an example, you'll see some properties in that spec like anchor origin, anchor from, anchor to, these kind of properties that when you think about something like Ion, who is very specifically targeting Bitcoin, doesn't need those properties. so we are very fortunate that in the working group, we were able to get to this consensus that these additional properties should be there and do enable these a DID method like Orb. So I wouldn't exactly call it a challenge. I mean, it was a very good group to work in. But I think we were also fortunate on the timing that we shifted this focus and were able to get the Scitree spec to be flexible for a method like this at that time. I think a challenge that we probably had was, you know, we were quite focused on Hyperledger Fabric at the time. And I think that this challenge of thinking about how do we have a DID method that is not just for the Fabric-based implementations was I think the biggest challenge we came into when we started on this work. If you no longer have a common backing structure like Fabric, then you need to come up with these alternate ideas like storing the relationships between DIDs into a different structure that is not actually on a blockchain at all. So I think those are a couple. And then, you know, just thinking about what are these common specs that we can pull down? What is the most common way to do like monitoring of a log right now, like certificate transparency, and just bringing all these pieces together into a new DID method that, again, is trying to invent as little as possible.
I think I'll add some character there because I think Troy's downplaying some of the challenges that we've had. For sure, you know, we were doing a lot with Hyperledger Fabric at the company. And so then when we were proposing to switch that out for an implementation of our own, there were a lot of raised eyebrows, like, that's a major change. How can we go forward with that? When we were able to convince our internal, stakeholders that, look, this is actually a better approach. It provides us with more flexibility, but we're maintaining the trust structures that were in Hyperledger Fabric, and we're able to sort of connect all those dots. Then we were able to make progress even internally for that. And then the other challenge that we ran into was this real-time component that I kind of mentioned, where there are expectations when using DIDs within our system that, you know, maybe the person is in a transaction at that time and they can't wait minutes for distributed networks to update. So how do we solve, you know, that engineering problem, and how do we drive throughput for a lot of updates, a lot of creations through the system and make them available, you know, in a distributed way. So a lot of that engineering had to happen. A lot of that engineering actually kind of came up at the end of the project, which is when you have to go back and look at what you did and say, oh man, how do I fix it? How do I change it? But the team of Orb developers here really, you know, were able to be successful and solve deployment issues and database bottleneck issues and message queue issues and all those things. So there were significant engineering challenges which had to be overcome to meet our kind of real-time expectations.
Yeah, I just want to like emphasize again, we mentioned it before that, you know, the engineering on this has been, I think, you know, more important than the spec itself. So yeah, definitely a big challenge has been, especially in decentralized identifiers, how do we have a highly performant DID method that has, you know, real-time like properties that can handle the throughput, that can handle the scale. And there's been a lot of engineering effort just on those aspects that, you know, is really buried below the spec level for sure. You can see like glimpses of it when you go to see the Orb implementation documentation. You can see some of the diagrams that have been put together about how we're handling the implementation side. And again, that's you know, below the spec level. So if you just see the spec, you might not realize the amount of effort that went into just the implementation of this.
Troy, I might count you as an optimist or a person of positivity because we started with challenges, but you kindly brought up the score, like the timing with the side tree spec was like a score, and it made me think, exactly. Oh, we should have a question, like what were the awesome things that happened along the way. Yeah. That was a really cool thing.
And you know, working with a great community is important, right? Especially when we're trying to come to a common goal. You know, I do hope that we can get Orb into, you know, a more standards, more multi-organization effort. I think that'd be wonderful. But on the other hand, of course, it was great that at the side tree level, which is specifying the operations, that we're already there. Right? We have this common format, at least at that level. So, it's great working in these awesome communities. It's great that, you know, when you have new ideas, even near the end of a spec effort, that you can still get them in and get that a spec like Sidetree to be at the flexibility level that it's at, that it supports both things like Bitcoin and a method like Orb that has no blockchain requirement.
So one of the challenges that I have with DID Ion, and I believe it's a Sidetree pattern in general, is the potential ambiguity due to late publishing. So is it with DID Orb, is it possible to prove that a given DID document is the definitive single DID document for DID Orb DID? And I think this might be a cue up for, you know, how does this witnessing stuff and whatever help solve that problem?
Sure. So I think there's a few ways to look at that problem, right? So first of all, when you get a DID document, and especially in ORB, when the clients are able to re-verify the chain themselves, you know that the entity or person or thing that had the keys was the entity that actually got the document to the state it's at, right? So you do have that comfort that to get to the current state, somebody had to have the secrets and keys to actually make that happen. Now, there's a couple of side aspects that you have to consider beyond that, right? One of them is, do you have the latest change, right? So just like systems like Git, they have a chain of operations that go from the current to the initial, and you have good confidence that you can re-verify that chain from current to initial, but you don't necessarily know that you had the latest. So ORB is using various mechanisms to give hints of where you can ask, do I have the latest change? It's doing push and pull mechanisms to actually propagate the changes as they go. And it is using witnessing so that you can have logs that are actually showing you which batches have been published thus far. The other thing you have to worry about in any side tree based method or any method that's basically giving the DID owner or the DID controller the full control of their own graph is, of course, that DID owner could produce two different histories. Because you're following basically a graph of changes backwards, if they provide a change at the same level, now they've basically created a fork in their own graph. And I want to kind of reemphasize again, in their own graph. It's not like some network consensus made that happen. It's the DID owner who had the keys caused the fork in their own graph. And that could happen, the owner basically publishes a change, you know, a year later to try to say they didn't have that key or something like that. And Sidetree, that's basically called late publishing. And you can read a little bit about late publishing in the Sidetree spec itself. In a method that uses a blockchain to resolve that kind of conflict, all they will say is take the first change, right? So whichever change was first published to the network, use that one as the definitive DID document. And because it's based on a blockchain, everybody will make the same choice, right? If I'm following a blockchain like Bitcoin and I see that batch of operations happen first, well, I will just use that one. Or because we don't have a blockchain, what we have instead is a set of witnesses who are providing signed timestamps of each batch of changes. And the rule in ORB is basically the same as these other ones, but instead of saying based on the blockchains, use the signed timestamps that you have from the witnesses to actually resolve that ambiguity. I'd say another thing that ORB put in, and this is what I mentioned earlier, this idea of anchor from and anchor to, is the DID owner can actually put into the operation, this operation is only valid to be published between certain timestamps. So you can actually declare that, oh, this operation is supposed to come in at, you know, timestamp one. And if somebody submits it a year later for some reason and never got published before, it'll be rejected as being stale. So that's the mechanisms we have in ORB for dealing with these kind of problems. To summarize again, many sources of where you can find the latest updates. The push mechanisms we have using ActivityPub, so we immediately publish to all followers what the DID operation changes are, so that within a network you have that list of changes and the witnessing structures that actually give timestamping to resolve these conflicts between which operation happened first, in the case that the DID controller themselves forked their own graph. Again, not the network, the DID controller did it to themselves.
To follow up a couple more questions about witnessing within DID ORB, the first one being just a quick spec clarification. Is there a difference between a DID ORB witness server and a DID ORB witness ledger? because both terms were used and it wasn't quite clear what the difference was.
Yeah, so I mean, the funny thing is I probably have to go back and see the specific instance, but in general, I think when we would write server versus ledger or log, basically the server has an API that you can access, and the log is, you know, a particular implementation, like the what we call verifiable credential transparency, or VCT, but is really just certificate transparency in the background. So ledger in the spec, or at least in our implementation, is mostly referring to the certificate transparency / VCT structures, and the server is referring to the APIs that are baked on top to enable ORB. An example of an API in ORB for that is the ActivityPub witness messaging mechanisms. So that's not really part of a ledger or a log, that's part of the server.
What are the implications in your mind of a DID ORB with no witness policy or no trusted witnesses specified?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, and the funny thing is, whether the implementation disallows it or not, like, that's an interesting question. I think it does allow it, if I remember right. But the implication is, if you don't have any witnessing, you don't really have a good way to break the ambiguity in this late publishing scenario that we talked about. And you don't have as much trust that the latest changes aren't just disappearing, right? Of course, in ORB, you do have multiple layers for this. So, you know, the fact that you have been publishing those changes on ActivityPub as a push, it's kind of, you can't really just take those back. So we already have that layer there. But when you have the log of changes in a structure like certificate transparency that are being monitored, and the ORB servers do actually monitor each other's logs like that, it's much harder to make operation batches just disappear. So again, why do you have these structures in the first place? It's again because of the late publishing problem that's described in Scitree. So the DID owner forking their own graph and then having this ambiguous choice about which fork in the graph to take. And we reduce that ambiguity by saying, take the first one. And if you have timestamps from witnesses and multiple timestamps at that, it's very much easier to make that choice. And knowing that you have the latest set of operations for that DID. And that's what the witness structures are basically giving to you. They're increasing your confidence, right? It's not that you have zero confidence without it, but it increases your confidence that you have the right result.
Troy, you mentioned this idea that you could specify a time bounds for an update, but I think I got confused trying to figure out who is setting the time bound on what activity. Because when I think of sort of naively applying that to how DID Ion works, and I'm looking at their late publishing problem, part of it is you don't know if it's on IPFS in the Bitcoin context. So you can publish Bitcoin and the asset isn't on IPFS yet. And IPFS itself has no temporality. So you don't know when it's, if it could have been there last year, it could have been there yesterday, but it's not there today. So could you just unpack again how that time bound process is helping?
Yeah, if you're applying the time bounding to a blockchain, you would put something like block height into there, right? Basically, it's saying, I want to see my operation included in a range of blocks, right? When you're talking about a system that doesn't have blockchains and is instead of based on timestamping, it's basically saying, I want to see my operation published by that server within some time bound, right? And you might put in like 30 minutes, because the most important reason you're putting that in there is so that if I create my operation, and again, these operations are only based on control of keys, that you don't want, if you submitted your operation and it got rejected by a server, you don't want to see that operation basically pushed in a year from now, right? instead, if it got rejected, you actually want it to expire so that it will eventually just, you know, go away. And so that's what the from and to properties are giving you, that in case there was a problem or like some server claimed they did not submit the operation, that server can't just, you know, submit it later. And so in ORB, it's based on timestamping. In other systems, it could be based on block height, although I don't think anybody else has actually used those properties in Xi-Tree thus far.
Okay, so if you're using IPFS as your anchor, you wouldn't be able to have this feature? Am I following that right?
If we talk about a system like Ion that uses both Bitcoin and IPFS, then you can use it because you can specify like the Bitcoin block number, right? If you don't have any blockchain and any timestamping capabilities, then yeah, you couldn't use those kind of structures. But I don't know anybody who has just done IPFS with Xi-Tree. It's usually in combination with an anchoring system.
I thought DidOrb, you could do that. So I could DidOrb with a scheme that's IPFS and I don't have a blockchain involved. So for those DidOrbs, I wouldn't be able to use this temporal.
For sure, but in DidOrb, you're combining it with timestamping, right? So you can just write to IPFS, but each of the servers that was creating the batches and witnessing for those batches that get written into IPFS are including the timestamps when they did that. So because Orb has that timestamping capability, yeah, you can just write the anchoring information to IPFS and it's fine.
Okay, because the time is asserted by the witnesses.
It's asserted by there's actually three sources of time in Orb. There's the witness when they're signing off that they've signed off on seeing that particular batch of operations. The server that actually published those operations is including their timestamp. And via the valid from and the anchor from and the anchor to properties, the DID controller themselves can provide their timestamps. So you can get timing information at all those levels. And then I'll just add on top of that, because we have the activity propagations, there's actually an additional source of time there as well about when was this batch actually published on ActivityPub?
The spec says that a DID controller is allowed to set a witness policy in which they specify a set of trusted witnesses that must be used when an Orb transaction has updates to the particular DID. Is it possible to not have a witness policy? And if so, can you still update the DID?
So you can basically not have witnesses in Orb, and that leads to the less confidence that we talked about. It's not that you need to have witnesses, but it does give you that confidence. I'll just add on to that, though, that sometimes the lingo in the spec wasn't quite up to date between things like the anchor origin and witnesses, and sometimes the language got... the same language ended up being used for both. So what is important, even without witnesses, is for the DID owner to specify the anchor origin. And the anchor origin is what lets the resolver get access to a source that tells them what is a hint of what is the latest updates available. So, of course, you can also say, well, you don't need that, right? And it's true that... If you're in a network where every Orb server is following each other and receiving updates, you don't even need technically an anchor origin, but I'm going to guess that our implementation requires it, if I remember right. Because if everybody's receiving updates, you don't need to query anybody about what's the latest because everybody would have already received it, right? Because we don't want to restrict ourselves to one particular network where everybody's tightly coupled to following each other, it is very useful to put for the DID owner or the DID controller to put their anchor origin property in so that we can query even across networks. And this is part of this idea that we should be able to create networks of networks and not just, you know, single islands where that island, of course, has followed each other and knows everything. So in the end, we want both, right? So you can have this tightly coupled island that all of those entities in that island know all of the updates, they're published immediately. But because we put extra properties in, if you share that DID outside, you can discover the DID operation updates. You can find out who can supply information about the latest updates, even outside of your own island.
In section 4.81 on discovery, I was a little bit confused, and I think maybe it's because it's only applying to one particular scheme of a scheme-based DID orb. But it says a client discovers a domains endpoint for DID resolution and DID operations using a dot well-known scheme. But if I've got an arbitrary DID orb, what domain are we talking about? Like the example mentions alice.example.com, but I don't know how that got into the conversation because there isn't a DID example. So maybe you can unpack.
Sure. So the reason for dot well known there is so that we can have a shorthand in the DID string and in the anchor origin property. So instead of having to supply an entire URI to the side tree, or sorry, the ORB API, I guess in this case, we can instead just supply, oh, this is example.com. And if you query example.com, you can get the dot well known, and the dot well known will give you all the API endpoints. That's of course like the very generic use of dot well known for any other purpose as well. In DidOrb, how did you find the domain? Well, there's a few places where that domain is coming from. One of them is if you include the HTTPS scheme, that domain will show up right there, right? So if I get a DID that says DidOrb HTTPS example.com, well, I can go to example.com, download the dot well known, get information about the ORB servers that are associated to that domain, and then query them about that DID, right? So I can query them to resolve the DID. I can query them to download the anchor files or the other side tree files. Another place where you're going to see the domain come in is the anchor origin property that we've been mentioning. And again, the anchor origin is set by the DID controller and is signed as part of the create and recover operations. So this is actually the DID owner declaring what their origin is. And when you look at the witness messaging, you can also see domains coming in there. So if you start browsing a set of anchor files and following the transactions backwards, you may discover new ORB servers, and then you can query the dot well known to actually find their endpoints.
So in terms of if all I have is the DID ORB DID, then the only place I'm going to get that domain name is if it's in the scheme.
If you get a canonical DID without the domain name in it, you can actually still get at that domain name. And that can happen if you've been following a set of ORB servers and they're propagating their DID operation updates to you and you've been applying those updates. Again, because the anchor origin is part of the create and recover updates, you may have already received that information via the ActivityPub messaging, even without having that discovery information. So if you have a network that's all following each other, you don't really need discovery because that information is actually coming from the message propagation. If you're not following those servers, this is where you need discovery. And with that discovery information, then somebody outside of your island of ORB servers, you can actually query from outside and find that information. And I should add that I keep mentioning HTTPS, but if you dig into it a little bit, it wasn't actually limited to HTTPS. You can actually do the same thing with IPNS, right? So you can create that discovery information within IPNS. IPNS is part of IPFS, if you're not aware. And you can include that discovery information within an IPNS address and then put the IPNS address into the DID ORB string. Right. So we've had this ideal where we can say, hey, if somebody is using ORB and can only use HTTPS, that's fine. Here's how you can set this up. And then those who want to not use HTTPS can, of course, use IPNS instead. That does lead to this interesting thing about if somebody says, I only do IPNS and somebody says, I only do HTTPS. Well, of course, they won't be able to discovery off each other, but that was the choice that those particular servers made.
So I think a couple of times so far, you've mentioned this term verifiable credential transparency or VCT, which I believe builds off of this idea of certificate transparency. Could you guys please just give us an overview of what this is, both certificate transparency and verifiable credential transparency?
Yeah, so verifiable credential transparency is certificate transparency with this small change where we said, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could put verifiable credentials into the Merkle tree that's defined by certificate transparency instead of X509s, right? The the spec for certificate transparency was generic enough to allow for this. You can make different types of entries that you can put into the tree. So what we did is basically defined a new leaf type, called it verifiable credential, basically. And our VCT server is storing the verifiable credential format instead of X509s. So when we say that the ORB servers are storing these witness entries, this is being stored in verifiable credential format. Certificate transparency is kind of a very well-known mechanism for monitoring the behavior of certificate authorities in the PKI world. Basically, the reason that it's there is if CAs are all publishing the newly issued certificates, and you happen to be monitoring that stream of newly issued certificates, and somebody issues a certificate for your domain that you didn't authorize, well, you can find out about it a lot faster. So there, there's very good information about how certificate transparency works. There's this certificate. If you search for it, you can find a very nicely laid out site that's describing a lot of the details behind it. The Wikipedia article is very good. There's the RFC about certificate transparency as well. And one of the reasons that it works so well is some of the browsers basically require certificate transparency to be used, right? So if you're in a browser that requires it, you'll know that certificate has actually been logged to an independent certificate transparency log, independent of the CA. And if you're monitoring it, you'll know that the domain owner can actually discover unauthorized issuance of a certificate.
So what is next for DidOrb?
Sure. So implementation-wise, we have done two release candidates, and we're working through, you know, some more minor issues going forward now, where we don't plan to break things anymore. So that implementation is going forward until we get to a V1. But again, it's already at the RC2 with some planning with RC3 that you can actually see on GitHub. Once we're, you know, finally very happy with the implementation, then we would go back and basically update any gaps that have ended up in the spec after the implementation changes. So then we can get the spec up to V1 and basically put the stamp on ORB.
So Troy, I'm going to put you on the spot a bit, and it's because I've heard that there may be some spec changes coming or some ideas around making DidOrb more compatible with DidWeb. I think that the DidWeb method is a great way, very accessible way, again, for organizations to host Did files, but then Did documents, but they kind of lack the history and traceability and trust that DidOrb offers. So I don't know, I think you've been noodling on some of those ideas on how to bring some of the capabilities of DidOrb into DidWeb without disrupting too much. I don't know. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, one of the concerns I always have about, you know, something like DidOrb and even any other Did method other than like DidKey and DidWeb is how many other organizations end up supporting a particular Did method, right? And this goes back to the interoperability problems. So, you know, one of the things that we've thought about in DidOrb is the ability to expose the current state of the Did documents as DidWeb, and basically have an also known as or something similar like that in the DidWeb document that actually can point back at the underlying Did method like DidOrb, right? So basically it's saying, hey, what if we're doing Did updates in DidOrb? And then basically mirroring them to a more well-known method like DidWeb, where if somebody who knows to look for an also known as or similar in the DidWeb document, and they see DidOrb sitting there in that property, you know, can they then go back to the DidOrb server and then re-verify the history that led to that particular Did document state? And again, this is in kind of the hopes of greater interoperability, but also somebody who sees DidOrb in the property there can also then get the confidence that the DID document in the DID document history and changes, right? So, you know, we haven't really done anything with that yet, but that is definitely something we've been thinking about. How do we kind of have these hybrid methods of something very simple like DidWeb that gives you the current state, but then also backed by the more complicated, but more confident history that led to that current state?
I think there's an underlying theme to DidOrb that maybe I can highlight, where we tried to make DidOrb as accessible as possible. So you don't need witnesses, but it's good if you have them. You don't need to check the witnessing history, but it's good if you do. The theme is a little bit like you can apply as much distrust as you like when you resolve a DID document as you're inclined to. So if you're a very, you know, trusting consumer of the resolution process, you're confident that you're talking to a trustworthy server, and maybe it's a low risk transaction, then you don't have to do all these complicated verifications of that history and the personal graph. However, DidOrb has been designed in a way that if you are in a truly decentralized scenario, you really don't have trust frameworks that you can rely on, and you really want to do your own homework and your own math on the reliability of a particular DID document and its history, all of these mechanisms are available. And so how do we then extend that to things like, well, maybe like a DID web, where DID web is very accessible, well understood by organizations that have, you know, existing PKI infrastructure. But what if they want to distrust it? What if you want to challenge that? Well, then DidOrb provides a history that you can then, you know, back up these changes with and have your own confidence that you're dealing with the right DID document, not just a document published on a web server.
Yeah, I think that's you know, very 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 good points there, Mike. Yeah, the design of Orb has been very much on the trust but verify approach throughout the whole process, right? And that, you know, more examples, even, you know, when we use certificate transparency, this idea that we don't have to wait for an entry to be created on the blockchain when we're trying to monitor it, because that's obviously a very big scalability and performance issue. Instead, we say, like in certificate transparency, the log is promising to insert within a maximum amount of time. And then you're trusting that it's going to do it, but then, you know, you go back and monitor that the log actually accomplished it. So you trusted that they'll do it. You didn't block any operations or slow it down. And then you come back later and actually monitor for it, right? So just another example of the same principles in Orb kind of very consistently applied. And I think what we've talked about here is what's the next level? And the next level is, yeah, like, what if we did something like DidWeb? So you get the DidWeb result, you trust it became because it's from a reputable domain, but then you can go back and actually verify that history using a mechanism like Orb, right? So that's kind of the next logical step in this trust but verify approach of Orb, coupled with this goal of creating networks of networks and not forcing each network to make the same choices about DHTs and blockchains and such.
So I'm going to put both of you on the spot here a little bit. When can we expect to see version 1.0 of DidOrb? Is there a timeline that you're working with?
So, I mean, I think the simple answer right now is, you know, we very much concentrate on the implementation lately. And so you already can get and play with and touch V1 RC2. And again, RC3, we're not expecting to break things at this point. In terms of going back to update the spec documentation, I don't think we've really put a timeline on doing those updates, but it's definitely something we should be getting back to.
How can listeners get involved with what's happening with DidOrb? Where is a good place to point them?
Sure. So, of course, if it's about Scitree, the right place is Decentralized Identity Foundation, the Scitree Working Group. If it's about Orb, then the current location is to go to GitHub and create issues and start from there. And the GitHub is github.com/trustblock/orb.
Besides did orb, what are your favorite did methods, both of you?
So that's a tough one, right? Because favorite for me, like, is very much based on how big is the did methods audience, right? So how interoperable is the did method makes it, you know, the most relevant for me, right? So did key and did web are obviously, like, very simple, but move the field forward, right? That's the important thing, I think, right now in decentralized identifiers, is to keep the ball rolling, right? And obviously, you know, with orb being a side tree method, and being very much aligned with what's in side tree, ion has been, you know, an important method, and an influencer method for the orb work. So it's easy to point to those. And also, the other side tree mechanisms that were, you know, based on Ethereum, right? But these are all side tree answers. Mike, did you have a few?
My answer is maybe kind of interesting. I mean, for sure, did key. I think it was on the did key podcast with Ori from Transmute, where we talked about did key. I find it as a great way to pick up the technology and get started with it right away. And then also did peer, for a lot of the same reasons that I you know, like did key, and that it doesn't actually require, you know, a blockchain to make use of, but actually sort of in line provides its own updates and its own history and trustability. I think did peer is pretty interesting as well. We haven't done a lot with it at, you know, on the secure key side in recent time, but you know, I was talking to Dan Hartman when he first kind of proposed the idea, and you know, we were involved at that time, helping to kind of formulate the idea of what did peer was about. I think those type of did methods that reduce the complexity of the blockchain component are probably my favorite. I do see a lot of value in having that registry and that ledger. To provide that level of trust. So that's not to say that I'm against, you know, the blockchain backed methods. I also sometimes see them as barriers to entry, and to get this technology rolling, I like to reduce those barriers.
Yeah. And I'd add a little bit, like, I haven't really been involved, with the Carry folks, but, of course, the Carry method does share some similar design points with Orb. I think we took the direction of building on top of things like Sidetree and certificate transparency and activity pub. But of course, the Carry folks have also been working on the similar ideas of, you know, blockchain independence and self-certifying identifiers, which are important points, right? So. I think there's, you know, several did methods that are in the same similar families, I suppose. So that's why I compare to Sidetree based methods because of the Sidetree protocols. But then also, there are methods out there that are, building on self-certifying identifiers and very much aligned with the, you know, ledger agnostic principles that are also important.
There are well over 100 did methods registered with the W3C. Are there any that the two of you would be interested hearing about on this podcast?
I guess maybe the question for you, I believe the European Blockchain Service Infrastructure, EBSI, has their own method. And I don't know. I would like to learn more about that. Let's just put it that way. I think part of it may be a reinterpretation of did key, because I think they might be making use of that technology to avoid, you know, putting identifiers on immutable ledgers. But I know that they're doing more with that. So I think if you haven't spoken to them, I believe they have their did EBSI, and if it's not in the registry, I can yeah, I can provide you with where I saw it. They have an interop spec where they mention it. So maybe that would be a fun one to find out what they're up to.
Great. I would love to see a link or a method or something. They're not currently in the registry, for what it's worth.
Now it's time for our shameless plug segment. Does anyone have a shameless plug today?
I tell you what, my mother is a painter. She's an artist. You can go to her website, mavarley.ca, and go buy all her art. And there are no NFTs available for that, so you have to get the painting.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
I love that, because in some of my communities, people ask, how can I support art? And one of my friends who runs a gallery says, buy art.
Yeah,
just buy art. I fully endorse that. Yeah.
And that will bring us to the end of our show today.
Troy, thanks for joining us on the show. Mike, thank you. Thanks also to our staff, our producer, Eric O'Connell, and my co-host, Eric Hsu. I'm your host, Joe Andrew.
Wherever you find the Rubrik podcast, please take a moment to subscribe to our feed so you'll be notified when our next episode is released. We look forward to you joining us next time.
The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed by the speakers in this podcast belong solely to the speakers, and not necessarily to the speaker's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual.